everyone, and welcome to Fraser's Capital Strategy Update. It's been a while since we've done one of these. We'll try and get these out kind of once a month. It was a pretty interesting year last year for many reasons. I'm obviously going to focus on the investing side of things. Obviously, there was countless tragedies around the world, both big and small. But we'll try and focus on investing just for the purpose of this podcast, just basically because it's what we do. We ended up having a pretty good year, even though it looked pretty sketchy at certain moments, to put it mildly. We kind of started the year fully invested, as optimistic as ever on technology, on the future, on innovation, that fast-growing companies that people love will significantly outperform. And things were going great until, I guess, the last week of February, when markets just nosedived. And it was the following, I guess it was 4 weeks, was the sharpest sell-off in 300 years in places that had markets that go back that far. So it's a very historic moment from a financial history perspective for all of us. And I think the interesting thing was it was unusual. I mean, typically you'd think the professionals would be the ones that, you know, support the market and it's retail people panicking. In this case, it was kind of the opposite. When you look at who was doing the net selling, it was actually professional selling and a lot of people taking their stimulus checks and buying their first shares in the market. I'm sure we all know people that bought their first stocks in March and done exceptionally well. We kind of see that as a good thing. I mean, it's good that somebody was there to support the market, and it's great that, you know, retail investors did well by doing that. Like, that was a stabilizing force coming in and supporting the market when they did. To move back to like where we were in our fund, we were down significantly. I think we dropped 24% in that quarter, and you know, the high to low was much bigger than that. But as things were falling, we made the decision that would maintain our exposure. We didn't want to play around with exposure. The reason for that is I used to spend time looking in 2008, 2009, trying to figure out how you could have played those better. And there's blogs that record trading market activity every single day. I mean, at the time, I'd bought my first shares in like 2006. And I'm pretty sure I sold all of them at the low. It was like a few thousand bucks. It was very, very painful at the time. But if you go back and look at 2008, 2009, particularly that kind of between September 2008 and I guess March, that 6 month period, there were weeks where the markets would drop 20%, rise 20%, drop 20%, rise 20%. There were these huge gapping movements. And basically the only way that you could actually survive something like that is to stay invested. You know, if you change your exposures during those periods, you could be offside 25% in 24 hours. And I think that actually happened to a few people this year. Whereas if you stay steady and stay invested, all those big movements are going to wash out. And as long as you're in the right company, as long as your companies are adding users and growing, they will be the first to recover and they'll push on to new heights. And actually what happened, that's exactly what happened back then. The companies like Apple lost half their value, but then rebounded almost immediately and then had one of the most extraordinary decades of value creation after. So that's the kind of backdrop that we had in our heads. The other thing that we think about is in these sell-offs, you have to buy on the way down, because when they turn, and they always turn at unpredictable moments, when they turn, that you usually got about 36 hours. You know, there'll be one big up day, you sleep, and then the next big up day. It's less than 48 hours, and a huge part of the move can have already happened. So it's very difficult on the way down. If you sell on the way down and try and buy in lower, which is effectively what everyone's doing, and when people sell, they generally want to get in at lower prices. It's very, very difficult to do. The other thing that you should just understand about the equity market is there's lots of supporting mechanisms, and people say, in the investment community, people don't like that. They think like the Federal Reserve is rigging markets. It's something you hear all the time. Think about what happened in March. You know, we had one of the sharpest shocks ever. The revenues of entire industries like travel, entertainment, they went to zero overnight. That's never really happened. I can't think of any instance. You know, even in like major wars, generally that's very good for industry and people still eat out, people still do things. But in this case, the whole industries went to zero. So it was an extremely sharp shock. But then there was this like united front from central bankers, politicians, left wing, right wing, regulators, not to mention every single person who put on a mask or stayed at home. Everybody just kind of united to kind of support the system and to help each other out. And that really marked the low. And so if you have to take a very negative approach to these things, you just got to be aware that when things go wrong, people pull together and they try and fix them. Bizarrely, I think it's human nature. It's like when things are going well, that's when everybody kind of turns on each other and gets all competitive. When things are going bad, I think by human nature, we all just like pull together. And it's, I think it's something that was was remarkable earlier last year, and it felt good to be part of it. It felt good to see, you know, society doing that. But back to stocks, we've said on the podcast before and on webinars and written about it that we focus on companies that are accelerating in the current environment. That was basically the case then. We just made sure every single company was growing really well and kicking goals. And it is most certainly the case now. So that hasn't changed. So the moment you could say that the sell-off was way too steep, you know, those companies shouldn't have lost 80, 90% of their value if they're small cap tech, or 30, 40% of their value if they're kind of large cap. You know, that was the long-term earnings power of these companies did not go down 30, 40%. You could also argue that the last couple of months, you know, that rally has been a bit exuberant. You could argue all these things, and who knows, really. That's kind of my view. But our strategy, as opposed to what we think, like what we actually do and how we invest, is to stay invested and make sure we're constantly in the winners. So we now have over 45 stocks. It's pretty diversified. We're not really stuck to anything. You know, we still hold companies like Afterpay and Carvana, Pinduoduo, which we've held for a very long time, I guess particularly Afterpay. But we'll keep holding them while they're growing at 100% year on year. Like that is the right long-term strategy when you're lucky enough to find one of these things. But if that should that change, because these are kind of 2, 3, 4% positions, it's very easy for us to just add more to one of the countless other you know, investment opportunities that we can see. Anyway, this is basically what we've kind of achieved. So we're actually in the kind of mid-30s net IRR since inception, outperformed by 20%. The median market cap's over 10 billion, and the average organic growth rate is now well over 75%. It's pretty close to it's above 90 now. So people know that we focus on companies with explosive growth, true customer love. It's a really powerful framework. You know, I wish I was thinking like this 5 years ago when Bitcoin kind of started becoming a thing, because it would have led you to the right decision there. Gives you the right decision on Tesla, right decision on Afterpay. Really kind of gets you the right question to the answer, which stock should I buy? There's extremely good fundamental reasons for that. The fundamental reasons for that are that these companies are investing heavily. So when they get revenues in, they spend it. They open up offices. They invest in human capital. They hire marketing staff. You can hire 10 people in a new country and open up a whole new market for a technology product, for a web-based product. That is not a cost. That is an investment. And the return on that investment can be tenfold or many times more. But conventionally, that's treated as a cost. So the reason I say there's fundamental good reasons is the companies that have that true love and explosive growth are able to then like roll out their products around the world. But if you look at their financial statements, you're just going to see these costs. You know, those costs subtract from EBITDA, they subtract from cash flow, they subtract from earnings. You cannot use those frameworks to measure these companies because it gives you the opposite answer to the right one. It tells you Tesla is a short, it tells you Afterpay is a short, it tells you software is a short. It gives you the wrong answer. It's not just like it doesn't give you the right answer, it gives you the opposite answer to what you need. And so that's why we find this so extraordinarily powerful, this framework. We now got some pretty big moves. So Plug Power is a big one. You know, that's gone up 14 times now. Tesla's close to 10 times. Carvana's close to 10 times. You know, I think there's more 3X opportunities we have that don't make the top 20. So kind of hoping to push this out. And like all these companies, again, they're kicking goals. Let me think. Every single one here is in the portfolio still. They're all doing extremely well. So we're just going to hold. You know, we actually believe in the five-year story for these companies. The rational, we're not going for 20, 30% moves in either direction. You know, we're not trying to catch things that fall 20, 30%. We're not trying to sell things that go up 20 or 30%. Final general point I'll make is that these companies are very large and they're growing really fast, and those revenues are coming from somewhere. So if GDP is flat, the revenues have to come from somewhere mathematically. So it's no surprise to us that a $50 billion company growing 100% year on year can perform exceptionally well when the rest of the market does very poorly. And there's heaps of examples of that. So what mattered in 2020? First, you were staying invested, which you talked about. Secondly, you basically rank your performance based on your exposure to tech. How invested were you in the companies of the future? That was actually also the case of the last 10 years. So people who run large funds, their investment performance based on how much they invest in Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Google, Microsoft. You could go back another 10 years. You could go back, you know, 100 years, and the people that stayed on the forefront of innovation in new industries probably did a lot better. Because all those, the new industries, like even the auto industry, that didn't exist. Think of that huge value creation that happened, the people were able to capture that stayed on the forefront. We actually expect this to be the case going forward. I don't know about the next month, quarter, year, but over the next 10 years, whether you're an advisor, whether you're an institutional allocator, whether you're a private investor with a tiny amount of money, or you've got, or you're in the later parts of your life and you've got a big super fund, self-made super fund, my guess is, or our belief is, your investment performance will depend on your exposure to these companies, because there's you know, several hundred companies that are just taking revenues from everybody else. You have to be on the right side. There are losers in this, on it from an investment perspective, and the more you stick to the winners, the better you're going to do. And I don't think that it sounds, that's so different to where most people are thinking at the moment, but I don't think that sounds crazy. I think that sounds crazy at all. Okay, I'm going to answer some questions that we got by emails. Firstly, Neo. So this is our biggest miss last year. Pretty angry about it. We looked at it like $5, $6, $7, $8, $9, $10, $15, $25. It's now $60. I think forget about buying it or not buying it. The reality is the Chinese are going to move electric. They've said that. They've flagged it in a million ways. It makes deep sense for them, for the cars in their big cities and motorbikes to be electric, because they don't make any noise and they don't pollute locally and they've got a huge smog issue. China is going to go electric. Now, Tesla, there's probably space for a handful of brands like Tesla and maybe some like luxury automakers, but the vast bulk of the Chinese will be buying domestically made vehicles, because that's just how they operate their kind of economy. The Chinese will want to do it, like from the highest political levels to probably the locals probably want to buy Chinese as well. And so these companies, NIO, and there's a few other ones, they will be enormous companies and they're already doing extremely well. But we do expect most cars in China to soon be electric and domestic suppliers to capture the majority of that. So to the extent we'd be buyers or sellers, we think it's really positive backdrop. At $100 billion, it's hard to tell how much juice there is in the short term, but this is definitely one of the kind of thing that's on our watch list. You know, it's got the 100% plus revenue growth. We rarely buy things now if they're not growing at more than 100%. That indicates that people are buying their cars, even if you don't know, even if you think NIO's cars look a bit weird. I actually think they look okay. The fact that you can see that the Chinese are buying them is the most important thing. So we're positive, if anything. When do we trim positions? So there's been a bit of evolution here. It's fashionable in tech circles to be really concentrated. And that's fine. I mean, there's many different ways to do this. And if people want to run their portfolios that way and they get two or three things right, they can do exceptionally well. We think actually the best play that makes most sense to us is actually have a diversified approach. So we have over 45 stocks. I think the largest is 6, maybe up to 7% at the moment. We actually want to maintain that portfolio growing at as close to 100% as possible. That's what we're trying to capture. And we're not trying to get 100% returns. That's certainly nice when we do. But we really just want to net 25% a year. I think it's about 25.8, 26%. If we do 26%, we will multiply the fund's capital by 10 times on a net basis every 10 years. And we want to do this for 20 or 30 years. So that's 100 or 1,000 times. It's very ambitious, but you know, you kind of need these things to drive you. And that's why we've got this strategy. So we'd prefer, you could argue that if we just invest in Afterpay, Carvana and Pinduoduo, which is pretty close to a portfolio of ours, you know, 18 months ago, would have done better. It's true. But, you know, there were days when the market was down 3 or 4 and we'd be down 8. At the moment, we've done very well in the sell-offs, you know, because there's just so many stocks that some of them are doing well. It's really kind of reduced the volatility and it really makes decision-making easier. Like you've got a 2% position that drops 30-40%, you haven't really lost much money. You can then take another look at it. It's very easy to add. Just really improves that level of decision making. Similarly, when we have new money come in, it's often a good way to kind of reallocate to other positions. There's no answer for this, by the way. It's everyone's just going to come up with a style that's consistent. And you know, the way we look at it is try and think of a strategy that you can run for 30 years. And I think if you have 2 or 3 20-25% positions, sooner or later, you're going to get two things wrong at once. And even getting one thing wrong at once, the stakes are really high. For us, we can be wrong on, you know, probably, you know, a number of our stocks at once and still generate positive returns that month, quarter, year, if everything else goes well. So that's why we've landed here and that's how we look at it. Got all these questions about austerity. So I made a comment in my last letter that, what was the comment? That basically I went to England kind of not quite 15, but close to 15 years ago. And then it was just a wealthy place. It was significantly wealthy. Like the pound was flying high. Australians were flocking there. we had a really nice atmosphere. I remember walking out in Piccadilly and just, this place is wealthy. Fast forward now and you do not get that feeling, you know, and it didn't take long. So basically they had a crisis that wasn't as bad as the coronavirus crisis. But then instead of society uniting to support the system, the kind of conservatives took power and then cut heavily everything. It was a case of tighten your belt. Sounds sensible, like reduce risk. Sounds sensible in March 2020. It's the wrong thing to do. Tightening your belt then meant that there was a really weak private sector. Investment bankers were getting sacked en masse, partly because of the crisis, partly because technology was just taking away all those kind of, for example, conventional equity trading jobs. And then onto that weak, horrible weak market where all these smart people were already unemployed. They sacked civil servants. They cancelled local programs. You know, upper middle class public servants became lower middle class, working for companies, not really doing much. And people who were working in the community in very low paid jobs all of a sudden had nothing. And it was a real sharp shift. Over that period, Australia had a commodities boom, but in the crisis, whatever government was in power, I think it was Kevin Rudd, gave stimulus checks to a lot of people, which was pretty rare at the time. Now it's super conventional. And you just see that shift in wealth, but it was more intense in Greece. So in Greece was like almost a proper West European country, you know, 15 years ago. And then they had something that was worse than the Great Depression in the US, longer and deeper and harder. Any young Greek that could left. Daily wages went down to 10 euros. The pension there's, you know, a few hundred euros a month. And that was the pension that everyone was cutting. Again, on a horrible job market, government spending had to be cut. You know, the water boats that service the islands that my family's from, you know, went from 3 to 1. So the island that, one of the islands I'm from, regularly ran out of water. So the taps just wouldn't turn. Like, it was just a horrible time and place to be, certainly from an economic point of view. And that's like austerity. That's what that would do. If there's a big crash and then you kind of tighten, you're going to make things infinitely worse or significantly worse. If there's a big crash, you support the system, then you're going to make, like, that's a good thing. Now, this question is more like, is there a point where that, can you do that? How far can you push that? And there's a lot of people that are saying now, well, you know, we just gave a lot of money to people. Everybody's prosperous, happy. You know, economically, everyone in Australia has done very well. I'll use Australia because we know it well. Why don't we do more support more often and really help people out that are struggling, given that, you know, it's clear the financial market can support it. You know, interest rates are still exceptionally low. It costs nothing to do this. You know, I'm pretty sympathetic to that view. I think that the intense amounts of stimulus thrown was absolutely the right thing to do from a society perspective, helped us from a portfolio perspective as well, from a society perspective. This idea of like debt ballooning to crazy levels and these like implosions, it's hard to describe because there's some things you just hear every year of your life, you know, and 15 years ago, you were reading about this in Japan, and Japan was, you know, more than two times debt to GDP, as in the debt was more than twice their GDP, which, by the way, is a false analogy. Debt to GDP, the units are not the same. GDP is a dollar amount per year. Debt is just a dollar amount. It's strange to be comparing them, but that's just what people do. You can clearly go pretty far. And actually, the way out of everything, basically, is growth. And so the problem with the kind of Greek austerity and UK austerity is you're constricting growth. The economies are shrinking. And your debt's just staying there. You know, it's actually growing because you're still losing money. So those ratios blow out. If you're growing, then those ratios very quickly come down. And debt, at the moment, there's very little inflation by conventional metrics. But as economies kind of grow, that's how you get the debt to GDP level down. So you actually want to stimulate growth in as many ways as you can. That is the way out. And it's the way that keeps people, you know, in jobs and the money in their back pocket. So the worry about the debt overhang has time and time and time again proven wrong. We believe that'll be the case going forward, with the exception if you don't have control of your currency and you know, you're, for example, Greece and the continent, and continental politics suggests that you need to tighten even when everybody there knows you should, because it's better for the whole if this place suffers. That's obviously not going to work either. Anyway, there's some thoughts on that. Life sciences. So there's a couple of new ones. I'm kind of wary of life sciences because I know that people just go out and buy what we do. Don't do that. These are small positions in a large portfolio, and we might trade in or out of them at any time. But we made a big deal kind of, I guess we've been 2 years ago, saying blood tests for cancer are real and they're going to be a big thing. Now it's like a super red hot part of the market. Garden Health has done very well. Burning Rock Biotech is like a kind of Chinese equivalent, which we like because it's again, if you look at their valuation metrics, you're going to say it's outrageously overvalued. But relative to the opportunity, I mean, the Chinese will not let any other country, a company from any other country, go in there and genetically sequence their citizens. Like, they're just not going to let them do that. They said they're not going to let them do that. And so they're going to foster local champions, kind of like Neo, you know. So Burning Rock Biotech is a market leader. And as that technology develops, it will be made available in China. And we're talking like more than three, less than 10 years before this starts becoming a thing. Like, there's already products in the market. This isn't science fiction. This is real. But Burning Rock Biotech and the local players will win that market. And that'll be huge. We also want one called DermTech. So DermTech's kind of cool. Basically, it's the same thing. It's like genetic testing for cancer. So to really simplify it down, if you have skin cancer, there's kind of two things you can do, or two points of the process where issues come up. First is you'll probably go to a GP and ask them to inspect it. They might get that wrong. But secondly, they'll probably take a biopsy, so they'll cut a little bit out. People don't want to do that unless they're really worried. And it's just difficult. Now, this is DermTech has got like a piece of sticky tape that they'll put on it, rip it off, and genetically test the cells that come off, and then give you with extremely high accuracy in both directions. So they won't tell you you've got it if you don't, and they will tell you have it if you do. They will tell you if you have, you know, a dangerous melanoma. And that's really exciting. And, you know, there's so many layers to this. In biotech, you need to get something approved and then paid for, and then you need doctors to do it. And in every country, it's kind of different. Like in some countries, they will decide to fund it, and that also means that that is now best practice. Like, for example, the UK. In the US, the FDA will like approve things, but that doesn't mean the key opinion leaders will back it. You know, it just means you can sell it. It also doesn't mean the insurers will pay. You have to get all those ducks aligned. And there's many companies that, you know, create a huge amount of value and a lot of speculative capital pours into them that aren't really well suited to crossing off all those things. In this case, it's going to save money for insurers, and the key opinion leaders have just come out and said they approve it and they think this is how it should be done. So again, it's had a pretty strong run, but it's a $1 billion company, and it's feasible for this company making $500 to $1 billion of revenue, you know, in the midterm. And so that's a new one that I thought I'd share with you, even though we don't really want to make kind of biotech recommendations specifically. But I think that's SPACs. So SPACs are old and they're new. They're an old vehicle, but they're new craze. They make a lot of sense, and I'll kind of quickly explain why. So these things, basically, they'll create a cash box. So, and they'll generally come out at $10 a share, which is unusual. Usually you can't use share prices to compare companies, but this time with SPACs, because they're generally 10, you can. Basically, they'll create a cash shell and then use that to merge with a company. And that's a way of coming to market. The other aspect is the person that pulls it together on merger will generally get a big chunk of equity, of effectively the cash box. And thirdly, there's often like options attached to them. So if a deal comes across, you'll get additional upside. Now, why is it? Think about the investors. So investor can put $10 into this vehicle. The manager, who might be Reid Hoffman, the CEO of LinkedIn, he'll then decide to buy something. That will then go to vote. And the shareholders decide whether they want to vote for it to be approved. If they don't, then the cash is handed back. If the guy can't find a deal or girl can't find a deal, the cash is handed back. So the reason people like them is I can put 10 bucks in. If they do an amazing deal, I'm going to vote for it. And some of the best performing stocks of the last couple of months have been these companies. Once they do a deal, they'll double, triple, quadruple. And unlike an IPO, the access isn't controlled by investment banks. You can just buy as many shares as you want in the market. And your downside is basically getting your $10 back. Your upside is, you know, getting access to the hottest new tech company that's coming to market. The sponsors obviously make sense. So the people pulling deals together because they get a huge upside. And for the companies, you know, IPO is a serious process. It's 6 months. You know, it's tightly controlled by investment banks. There's a range of inefficiencies in the process, probably overplayed inefficiencies, but a range of inefficiencies in the process. But really, it's just a long, difficult road for these CEOs. When you speak to them, they're like, it's long and difficult going to IPO. You can't do it trivially. SPACs, you can very quickly, you know, just do a deal, sign an agreement, and it's done. You don't need to do roadshows. You don't need to make certain commitments. They're a really interesting vehicle that kind of works for everybody. So I just started to share that because there's a lot of criticism. Let me stop share now and see what questions we've got. Which one of our stocks in 2020 didn't do well and why? We had a couple of biotechs at the start of the year, which you do not hold now. So one was, what was it called? Avita. So it's one of the burns providers. We actually did a lot of work on it, and it was clearly adding a lot of value and has lots of growth opportunities by applying their technology. This is a spray on skin company. But the revenues just didn't come through. And I think there's a lot of companies that will grow very quickly to kind of 20, 30, 40 million revenue, but that's kind of a cap. And often then at that point, if your expense base is 50, 60 million, you're just losing money, but you're not really growing. And I think that perhaps there's something like that going on in the burns market where there's not that many people that get serious burns, thankfully. And so the value was really in the future prospects, but we traded out of that. We traded out of a lot of things when we made that pivot in March, April to companies that were accelerating coronavirus, which is pretty good. I mean, because we got all those e-commerce companies, digital health, a lot of new things that we weren't invested in. But there were a few things that we got rid of, and there were a couple of examples of local biotechs that we held then. Which companies in life sciences are you most excited about for 2021? There's a couple. There's like, I'm quite interested in, obviously, it'd be interesting to see what Moderna does now, because they should be selling at like $30, $40 a dose. They should be selling hundreds of millions of doses. They should be getting, I don't know if it'd be 10 billion, but certainly billions and billions of dollars of genuine free cash flow. They've got a huge pipeline, and they can just indefinitely expand that pipeline by creating new mRNA treatments. So it's really interesting to see that makes the leap to like a major biotech, like a Biogen or an Amgen, which will be another 3 to 5-fold increase in price. There's other companies that focus on, like there's a company called Alnylam, which does sort of mRNA, it's RNAi. It's a different type of, how to describe it? I guess messaging. You can play around with that. But again, the same principle is that if you have the right DNA stretch, the machinery on either end that kind of makes it all happen is the same. You can then roll out treatment after treatment. Now, Alnylam has a few already. So they're very successful, and they can also roll that technology out to an extensive pipeline. I met the kind of chief scientific founder of Moderna, who also founded Alnylam, who also founded another company that I think sold for $4 billion, who's now doing his fourth company in Oxford called Evox. He's already kicking immense goals. So I've been aware of that whole space for a while, and there's a few things like that that are really interesting. But I really want to see Dermtech succeed as well. Is Biden Democrats positive for Frazzis? It's positive that stimulus is going to keep going. It's positive that we had one stock that was in the cannabis sector. They basically sell shovels. They retail like hydroponic equipment and things like that, like literally selling shovels. We liked it because obviously they're growing 150%. Actually, there's two reasons we liked it. Firstly, the like-for-like was 70%. So each store was growing at 70%, which is unheard of. I've never seen a retail company with that high like-for-like. Secondly, there's a whole series of plays kind of not less now, but maybe in the 90s and 2000s, like Peter Lynch plays where there's like a retailer that does really well, a restaurant that does really well in a small number of states, just rolls out across the United States. We kind of see that with this company. And the reason I'm mentioning it is obviously the Democrats are positive for that space. The danger was that a tightening right-wing government got in, but Trump was on the pumping side of money. I wanted to support the system and keep markets high, keep unemployment low. Like that were his focuses. He didn't have some weird focus on government debt. That, you know, it's so, when you think about it, it's so bizarre how people obsess about this stuff. Anyway, I won't get sidetracked. Broadly, it's probably positive, but you know, if we have to guess, things are going to run real hot from here. You know, you've got recoveries, you've got vaccines, and you've got stimulus continuing to go and interest rates low. Things are going to get real hot. And then they'll get really cold. But we're just going to do what we do. We're just going to keep our portfolio consistent and make sure our companies are adding users' revenues every single day at as high a rate as we can possibly find. So it's about self-wealth. We do not actually hold self-wealth anymore. I think they're the best at the moment. I think they'll probably win the market, but I worry that I worry that their key selling point is price. And broadly, we sold out because of that. We thought there might not be quite enough. And we'd love the company to prove us wrong. But that is why we don't hold it anymore. You mentioned before to be careful with higher multiple B2B software. Do you think the market fully understands that some of the winners will see accelerated sustainable growth? Coop, CrowdStrike. Are those two be on CrowdStrike? Ultimately, we plug these things into our models, right? I should have actually made a slide and showed you because I think it'd be helpful. If something can maintain 50% growth for like 5 years, it's going to be 10 times the size, roughly. These companies are all extremely cheap on that basis. So a 30 times sales company might actually be 3 times 5 years out. A 40 times sales company looks expensive, and it is, but it might be 4 times 5 years out. So let's say, what if in 5 years it's not trading at 4 times sales, it's trading at 16, which is cheap, which is for these kinds of things where like the revenue is basically gross profit. If that's the case, you'll make 4 times in 5 years, and that is, you know, a great return. That's like if you do that over the rest of your life, you'll probably die a billionaire. You know, that's an exceptional rate of return. So we think we own some of this stuff. It's probably, these are things you kind of add when you get the chance, when they're momentarily, you know, there was a moment recently where a lot of software traded sideways. I think they peaked in August, September, and then basically gone sideways for 4 or 5 months. So the companies were growing, the share price was sideways to down. The multiples actually compressed a surprising amount of time. Like time goes really fast. Like those years go by like that. 6 months goes by like that. And then these companies could be 30, 40, 50% larger. That's kind of like what happened to CrowdStrike. So, the long-term holders will absolutely win in those cases. That's our opinion, particularly for like Cooper and CrowdStrike and the really good ones. I hope that answers the question. Is anything different, interesting on your watch list for 2021? Look, we're going to go hard on life sciences this year because we think it's independent of the growth space. Probably got about 20% of the fund in maybe 10, 15, probably about 10 life sciences stocks. If you include digital health, it's probably close to 30% of the fund. We like those things because very few people know about them. Very few people study them. You can use the same metrics that explosive growth. The love part is slightly different. You focus on the doctors, the NPA, and the payers, and try and figure out if people actually want it, which you can do just by speaking to them. I've got an old friend of mine who's, you know, Yale Medicine, you know, done research at MIT, UCLA. He's now advising us pretty closely on this stuff. It's been exceptionally helpful. That's probably our key focus. And we're always trying to find a company growing 100% year on year, trading on 5 times sales. So we're always looking for that stuff. And we missed a couple. It's very annoying. We missed Neo. Well, there was online broker that I just saw tripled since we kind of put it on the watch list a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, do you ever consider European or Canadian companies? Yeah, look, we're pretty agnostic. It's pretty hard to find. We definitely would. I think in Europe, there's amazing companies. They're often private. Canada, I guess we've owned Shopify. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we've owned in Canada. Nothing off the top of my head. Spotify, we talk about every now and then, but we don't own it because the growth isn't high enough. I prefer 100% grower of similar market cap than something growing at Spotify's rate, though we are believers in it. You know, once you have that user base, you can slowly increase prices, you can add podcasts, you can add new features. Those platforms will be really good. Any comment around the tech bubble that some are predicting will burst? Yes, very much have comments. The people who just long-term stay invested in this stuff are going to beat everyone else. That is what we believe. At the moment, we might be in the early stages of a bubble. I'd say things were too cheap. Like the sell-off was irrational. Things were way too cheap in March. A software company trading at 6 times sales with 91% gross margin is nonsense. Like that is insanely cheap. I'd be surprised if we see that again in our lifetime. If you think about what's going to happen, you know, like these companies, our company's growing at 5% a month. So yeah, there could be a tech bubble. Maybe things rip over the next 2 years and then crash. And then 3 to 4 years later, our companies could be, you know, 5, 10 times the size. Oh, not 10 times. They'll be much, much, much bigger. And so from this point to that point, we could still be up. But irrespective of whether there is a bubble or not, or if we're at the top of the market or the bottom of the market, we're just going to keep consistent because that's what's going to work over the next 30 years. And we have high confidence that it's not even high confidence. You know, again, this is something you hear every day of every year, your entire professional career is tech bubble and tech stocks going down. The real winners are the people that back the companies and stick with it and don't trade around. Firmly believe that. And that has been the experience. I'll talk about another one. So tech bubble, everyone took the wrong lesson from the tech bubble. So the tech bubble, the dot-com bubble, the original bust, there are a handful of managers that didn't get caught up in it and then significantly outperformed. They then kind of locked in the beta and systematically underperformed for the next 20 years. And it's only now in 2021 that their net returns since inception are underperforming. They took the wrong lesson. The lesson of the dot-com bubble wasn't that there was a huge crash and people lost their money. It was that the internet revolutionized the world and tech was the place to be. You know, if you invested in 1996, 7, 8, 9, and then stayed at the forefront, you know, of technology, and I know indices, it's hard to say because it's so different. Like, for example, if you got hit really hard in the dot-com bubble, like worse than the index, lost most of your money, but then caught software at the right time, you would have made a fortune. You know, if you just stayed invested through that period and stayed committed to innovation, which basically means companies changing and improving the way we live, you would have invested in the best returning sectors, you know, ever since. And so we think that, like, those things are unpleasant. We want to be around for 30 years. If we can achieve that, if we stay healthy and in business, we will see these two-year bear markets. We'll see these crashes. We'll also see absolute euphoria. We're pretty confident that as long as you're picking high-quality companies that are growing, you know, 100% year on year, you'll end up significantly ahead. So that's how we think about tech bubbles. It does feel pretty hot right now. I will agree with that. What metric do you look to use at life sciences stock? It's less metrics. I mean, most of the ones we invest in actually have revenues, so we do want to see those growing at 100% plus. You've got to get a feel. You've got to speak to, this is a field for specialists. You've got to speak to the decision makers. So the reason it's the same as everything else is you focus on the decision makers. Like the decision makers where you buy one product over another, use one burns treatment over another. You decide to go down this approach or that approach. Many conditions in medicine, there'll often be competing approaches. And then you've got to try and figure out why people are making it one decision over another, and then zoom into a particular company and why people are picking that company or not, or why will they pick that company or not. And it's a really easy way to do that, and that's to speak to the people that make those decisions. And they'll tell you really quickly if, because there's companies, you read the presentation, like, this is the best, next best thing. You speak to people in the field that don't know about it, and then when they look at it, they go, okay, that's obviously not going to work for this reason. It might even be like not a good reason. It might be like, well, we make a lot of money for doing this operation, so we don't want this like $100 treatment. You know, that's like a stylized example of how cynical it can be. It's not that bad, but there are instances where, you know, the doctors are compensated in particular ways. Or they'll have to retool like a hospital, and that will take a very long time. We've seen a lot of things like that where it kind of makes sense, but then you've got to think that, okay, each hospital is going to have to make a huge capital investment, and there's other spending priorities for these hospitals as well. So just because that might be the optimal solution for one particular thing, maybe re-kitting a room should be used for something else. There's so many things that go into these things, but they're usually pretty cool. You can usually find them out if you speak to the people that actually make those decisions. And I think that's one of the things we do very different. So most people boast about talking to management. Like, we talk about management. We're best mates with management. Here, come. Look, I've brought the CEO of this company. Come meet them. You know, that is, we don't do that. We have surprising access for our size, but they're the wrong people to speak. They're the salespeople. You want to speak to the people making the decision, whether it's in the life sciences or anywhere else. And that is where we focus. And that is, I think, differentiating to what we do. Any thoughts on Inspire Medical Systems? I know the company. Let me have a think. I don't have a strong opinion on it right now. Given the market's run up, what is your approach from 2021 for new capital? Okay, so new capital for us, you should think of us as fully invested in the best and fastest growing and most loved tech companies we can find. If money comes to us, we then allocate it. So we're always basically fully invested, maybe 5-10% either side. That's how we think it. In terms of cryptos, we actually had one listed crypto investment, which did exceptionally well. Small part of what we do, would never buy coins direct. We work really hard to make custody easy. We want everything to be listed and everything to be kind of like listed equities, basically. So we always know the price of everything. We don't, and there's very well-worn custody solutions. So people have confidence that, you know, the capital is being managed properly and there's proper custodians around it. It's a bit harder in the crypto space. You have to take a lot more risk on that. So we will never buy a coin direct in the fund. I mean, never say never, but if we did, we'd prefer to find a company in the space that was growing explosively fast with a devoted user base. That is how we'd look at crypto. We'd happily invest in a company that hit those markets. What increase in interest rates will stop you holding 40 times sales companies? We hold very few 40 times sales companies. Interest rates have kind of started rising a bit now. We just need to make sure the growth rate vastly outweighs the 20 to 30% multiple contraction, which will come. In our case, our company is growing at 5, 6% a month. We're confident that holding them is the right strategy, rather, because the interest rate rise, who knows when it will come. And if they rise too fast, they're going to cut again, which is what happened in December 2018. So rise, stocks will fall, and they'll cut. Any of you on Edge Computing, CDNs, Net and Fastly? Yeah, I really like both those companies. We do not own them, for better or worse, but as far as I can tell, they're amazing companies. What are your thoughts on the Affirm IPO? Yeah, I just don't think it's as good as Afterpay. I mean, Afterpay is kind of towards the end of their journey. They're increasingly mature. I think it's striking both Tesla and Afterpay, which we've talked about for years because everyone's so cynical about them. And we get grilled on them for holding them. Both of them changed their industries. So Tesla made every car factory in the world, every car manufacturer in the world now has to retool. They just did a huge capital investment cycle. They're all going to have to invest a huge amount of capital building electric vehicle factories. It's almost comic. Like, I can promise you these companies did not want to do that. The industry did not want to have to retool all their factories and supply chains to electric. Tesla's forced them to do it. Afterpay has also forced Square, Shopify, PayPal to copy them. I guess imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. We always said that PayPal was going to have to respond to Afterpay, and that has proven right. PayPal has had to respond. These are not large positions for us, by the way. Like, they're well below 5%. I think Tesla will be about 2.5. Afterpay will be about 4. So it's not like we're super gung ho or super reliant on the future trajectory of these companies. But that's how we look at it. We haven't bought in the Affirm IPO, and at the moment don't have any plans to buy the stock. Okay, cool. That was a lot of questions. Yeah, I guess the takeaway are, look, we run a diversified portfolio, ultra high growth companies with intense customer love. We're going to do that through thick and thin. That's a strategy, because we think it's the right strategy long term. And that's what we do. If you have any more questions, let me know. Otherwise, I hope you have a lovely day and a lovely weekend. Thank you.